The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 272 for Wednesday, May 4th, 2011. My name is Jim Race. I am here with Jules Cisek. Martin Darlington will be joining us hopefully soon. He's busy off flying and doing other stuff. But how you doing, Jules?
Doing good.
Cool. We had a great weekend of racing, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Well, really great. We had a weekend of racing.
Yes, we did. We had a double weekend of racing, so you can pick and choose from the series that you want, both MotoGP and British Superbike. We do have some great interviews this week, however, because our man on the ground, Gonçalo Silva from Portugal, was in Portugal, Estoril, and managed to snag us some cool stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, that's amazing stuff.
Absolutely. We've got a few bits tonight. We've got couple of interviews with Cal Crutchlow. Very cool. We'll also roll one that actually kind of dovetails, if you think about it, with a great bit that David Emmett wrote on Moto Matters talking about Moto 2. And he kind of gets a little bit of talk about Eskil Suter, and you'll actually hear from the man himself in this interview. And then we'll close out with a rather unhappy Kenny Noyes. But in the meantime, let's just briefly talk about, and I want to say many, many thanks for a donation. And this is outside of a program we're going to talk about shortly by a friend of the show, longtime Christina Sua. Thank you, Christina. Much, much appreciated. You want to talk about Kickstarter, Jules? Fill us in.
Right. So as you know, if you're following...
Oh, wait.
What?
Was that better?
Yes.
Okay.
That sounds good.
Carry on.
So, as you know, Jim is planning to be at the Isle of Man TT, but we are a little bit short on funds. The Kickstarter is a website where you can pledge money towards a project. The project in this case is to send Jim to the Isle of Man, and we're trying to raise $2,250 for to cover airfare and stuff, and the way Kickstarter works is you pledge how much you'll be willing to help out, but you only actually funding only goes through if the entire project is 100% fund or more funded.
Yep.
So, but it's not you don't just pay for nothing, because we've got some really, really cool stuff to kind of reward anybody who does send in some bucks to the drive, including photos that I've taken at various tracks over the years,
and some incredibly cool ones too. He's got a great selection of them.
There's 50 photos that I picked from all the way going back to Laguna 2005 up to 2010 last year, and then we've got some one-off items that Jim and I have collected. There's some mini champs.
Mini champs, the very, very cool diecast 112 bikes. And these aren't, you know, the kind of, you know, Bellray ones that you get. These are the hardcore collectibles, and they're all new in boxes, including what, as it turns out, is a pretty rare Valentino Rossi we might put up at the end of, I think it was 2005 at Laguna Seca. But these things are cool. If you guys don't have one, they are pretty much badass. We've also got a couple of shirts that I have picked up. And in fact, if I need to, I can found a few more that I might be able to add to the mix. But just in case people are wondering, the size of the shirts, I believe, are both large. And the European large is apparently much larger than my large. one is a 2000, I believe, 6 Kawasaki pit shirt. These aren't, you know, just regular ones. These are full embroidered patches, the whole nine yards, very heavy duty, same kind of stuff they wear in there. Well, the stuff they wear in there, as well as a 2007. This is the blue Galois blonde factory Yamaha shirt. You've got the one Uber prize, Jules, which is the Day of Champions posters signed by, well, all the legends.
I won it at a auction for the Riders of Health. It was Randy Mamola that was auctioning it off, and it's got his signature among people like Don MD and Wayne Rainey and Eddie Lawson. I mean, everybody's on there, so it's an amazing thing, and it's nicely framed. So for anybody who wants to pitch in, you know, the big one, this is waiting for you.
So it's very cool. Jules set this up. We will be doing updates as things go on, kind of give you guys some additional information. And just to mention, this is not for like beer and pizza money while I'm out there, folks. I had an unfortunate set of circumstances kind of drained or completely depleted the fund that I had set aside to go to the island. So what I'm saying is that I'm not going to be able to go unless you fans can step up and help us out. I'm not begging, but I'd love to go, and I'd love to cover it for everybody out there in Motopod land. It would be very cool. And it's a great opportunity for you to not only give back to the show, but also to get some cool stuff from us.
Yep.
Yep. In the meantime, and we should probably do this, Jules, and thank you, once again, everybody out there that does donate. If you can't do it through there, by the way, you can always do it through the Motopod fan page on Facebook. If you don't want to use PayPal, feel free to send us an email and I can let you know how to, get a hold of us directly. Anything would help.
But please, if you're donating now, use the Kickstarter so that we can reach that goal. Otherwise those funds will not get released.
A very, very good point. Don't neglect signing up for something. That is a good point. It's kind of important because we do have to make that threshold and plateau.
Yep.
I think it's time to run an interview.
We've got some great ones. So let's start off with Cal Crutchlow on Friday.
And we're going to do the double, aren't we?
Actually, let's do him on Friday and Saturday.
All right, we're here with Cal Crutchlow in the very rainy Portugal at the moment. Cal, how's it been? How's the track looking for you?
Yeah, it was good a few hours ago when it was fucking dry, but now it seems to be shit and raining. I'm glad we had the first day, testing. You know, the first three practices were dry. This will give me, a look around the track. I know where I'm going now, and we can make a progression again tomorrow, hopefully. It's different, a lot different to what I thought it was going to be. Very bumpy, very narrow. A lot of the corners suck you in, but no, I'm pleased enough that things came the way it did.
How's the arms doing about the arm pump? Have you been?
This morning I had some arm pump and some bad feeling, but now it seems to come better. I don't know. We need to have a look after this race again and see if we can cure the problems.
Yeah, right. You did a really good result at Jerez, which was the first time you've been around the track. And Esrel, so far you've been doing a pretty good job. You think that learning new track this year is not going to be much of a problem for you?
But because of the bumps, because the corners are tight and you think they're more open and... in the end, I think going to some other circuits, I think it might be more difficult, but maybe I'm a bit of a fast learner, I don't know, but it seems that we're okay because to be only 1 second off after the second free practice is good. The guys have been coming here 10 years, not 20 laps, the same as me, so... It's not so bad.
What's the expectation for the weekend then?
I don't know. Maybe it'll rain. But because of the bumps, because the corners are tight and you think they're more open, and in the end, I think going to some more hand side, just trying something. But nah, I never used them in the end. I just wanted to see.
Yeah, all right. Well,
you go always thinking about stupid shit.
Well, let's come up with something different that can give you the edge.
Yeah.
All right, man. Thank you very much.
Mate.
And see you the rest.
I'm looking forward to the rest of the weekend.
Yeah. At least you know how far you can push the wet tires now.
Yeah, to the point of crash.
We have Cal Crutchlow again. after qualifying Saturday in Estoril. So let's start with a simple hours qualifying. How did you feel with it?
Yeah, not too bad. We have a little complication with the arm. But to finish middle of the third row at a circuit I've never been to before is okay. I'm happy with that. And it's difficult here. It's not an easy circuit. Fucking hell, it's probably the hardest one I've came to so far. But I think we go, you know, we can at least know we have the speed again. And most of the session we were in a good position. I'm happy enough. So if we can continue this tomorrow, I'll be very happy.
All right. You set out most of the free practice, the third free practice. You set out just no point going to the track with that weather.
Well, shit. You wreck a set of tires. You wreck a set of wets, and then with the slick, you just end up wasting your time. So it's too dangerous. I thought I'd just leave it, because if there is a flag-to-flag race tomorrow and we have to change bikes twice, I have an extra set of tyres.
Yeah.
So
they're an advantage compared to everyone else at that point. Well, you're saying that it's the track is the hardest you've been so far in the MotoGP bike. What do you feel that?
I think because it is so tight, so twisty and so bumpy, and the corners suck you in a lot, you know, so you make too many mistakes and you have to be so smooth, and the more times you go around the track, the more you learn every time. So for Jerez is a lot easier than here, a lot.
Yeah. But it kind of reminds me of home riding with the English tracks, isn't it?
Yeah, it's some of the English tracks are better than this.
Well, yeah, it's not a good circuit. Everyone
they should
knows,
go to Portimao.
Yeah, that's the place where you should be next. I don't know, have you been hearing anything about Estoril not making the calendar next year? So in that part. So maybe it might change for Portimao. No one knows at the moment. But yeah, you've been there, you won the World Championship there. It was a fantastic race you had there. And it's a cool venue, you know
if
it
we
is.
Went to that, it would be cool.
Yeah, alright.
It'd be entertaining on a GP bike. Fucking hell.
Just going through that crest on the straight. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, like, good to see you there. Well, talking about super bikes, you were obviously world champion super sport 2009, and then you moved into the Cyril Garde Yamaha team. But you just stayed 1 year. Do you think, 2 years there could have got you the world championship too before moving to MotoGP? Because you had a little bit of an inconsistent. What could be considered a little bit of inconsistent
from the start but after from halfway through the year or round 5 I was second in the championship by 3 points, so I could have nearly won the title from the second half of the year.
What was going wrong?
Well, the bike was a pig at the start of the year, and then it came together because we had to work hard. How Ben won the championship on this bike, I don't know.
Is the bike you used was the same bike you used? Was more or less
but
the same?
Yeah, we completely changed. Completely changed everything on it. At the start of the year, it was the same, and then we changed the settings a lot. We couldn't change the tank, which was the worst problem, where the tank was positioned. But
there was no way you could.
Now they have. So, I think I didn't want to stay in Superbike. I can go back and win that when later. Yeah. You don't always get the chance to come to GP.
Yeah, it was a perfect time.
And I got the chance, and then, you know, if to get the chance to come to Moto Grand Prix, I needed to take it while I can.
Yeah. So. And, when you went to Superbikes, you had big shoes to fill, well, obviously, with Spies winning the championship, and then you're basically following after him. You just stay 1 year in Superbikes like you did, and now you moved into Tech 3 Yamaha like you did. But you planning on staying around Tech 3 for a while, or just?
Yeah, obviously everyone is still in contracts in factory teams, and you know I have a 2-year deal here with Tech 3, so I'll be here next year, and then we see from there. But the team is good, you know. I think they're very experienced with rookie riders, so it's good for me to be able to come in and
How was the comfort with the team getting, like you said, getting rookie riders coming in with Ben, with you? and then having Colin as your teammate, does it help, like, give you a little bit of that comfort to know you have the team there that knows how to deal with guys that come from super bikes, from completely different tires and way to ride bikes?
Yeah, I think having Colin is difficult because he rides completely different, but he has so much experience with track knowledge and tracks and thing, and with the bike, you know, he can always give good information. But if I'm asking him how to ride the bike, there's no point, because we're two completely different. He is completely different from Ben and Jorge as well.
What's the main difference that you feel like, compare your riding style to his, for example?
He just releases the brake and lets it off, where I would carry a bit more, and they're just a lot different.
Well, but that comes a bit from superbikes, like carrying a little bit more, trying to not put that much load into the front and all that. And
yeah, so, but you know, he is very extreme compared to the others as well. So even Jorge, who's been Grand Prix racing for forever, so Colin will release the brake first between all of us normally.
That's interesting. And riding a MotoGP bike, well, from the outside, everyone you hear about riding a superbike kind of looks like riding a normal bike, that kind of, like, you shouldn't load too much the front brake and all that. And then you come into MotoGP, it's like, well, forget everything you learned about riding motorcycles. This is a completely different game. Do you feel like...
It's the opposite way around. It's just the complete opposite way around. Well, the more you brake, the better it is. And, you know, superbike, if you more you brake, the more you crash. You know, the difference is the tyres. The chassis and tyres, because they're so stiff.
Mm-hmm.
Pirelli is so soft, and the superbike chassis is so soft that you would just lock and crash. So
yeah. Here you need to have that load in the tire to keep the bike turning.
Yeah.
So how about the season? How is it going? Like, the expectations are being filled as you thought, or you're expecting a little bit more? You're doing more or less the same results as Toslin did when he came in.
It's a lot different to Toslin. The pace is nearly 3 seconds faster.
Well, yeah.
So, and the competition now is three times as hard.
No, that's also true.
So, I think also Toslin was on Michelin's, which was an advantage at the time. Now everyone is on the same. When he went to Bridgestone's, he fell apart.
Say that you could compare the two of them, like, directly. I mean, as coming in, you've actually been doing what we consider good results, like, as you said, with the group that you have been running in front of you.
Yeah.
Where you think you can go from here in terms of improving results? Where you think, how close you are from?
Go to some circuits I know.
Yeah. Silverstone. So, what do you think about? You won Superbike there twice last year.
Yeah.
Two races. It's a track that you like. It's the track that you're going to feel comfortable. And having the home advantage as being an Englishman there.
Yeah. I want to win by 1 minute. But I don't know if it'll happen. Well, I just do my best and see, you know. Yeah. But even when we go to Assen and Misano and some places, actually, no, it will be, you know,
yeah,
a lot nicer.
Yeah, talking about Toslin, it's one of those things. How was your relationship? Because I remember reading the Marmite comment. I don't know if you remember that. Was your relationship with him okay? Did you get along and all that?
Yeah, we get along now. We didn't particularly when we were teammates, but that's...
Well, that's the first guy you want to beat, right? So... Sunday, it's coming up, the weather, let's see if it stays dry or not.
It will be dry,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. Where you expect to do? Because you did 1:48 today, you've been running a pretty consistent pace, not doing too bad at all. And is that, you want to stay and try to improve being top eight maybe?
Yeah, I think if I would be happy with a top 10 finish, because I still have 3 world champions behind me, at least 3. So, you know, to finish in the top 10 is going to be still difficult. But yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, and maybe catch up with you after the race on Sunday.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
Thanks very much, Gonzalo and Kyle Crutchlow, obviously. Loved hearing the rain, the atmosphere of that day. Basically, the Friday, was it Friday practice?
Yeah.
The second practice was thunder, rain, hail, you know.
Lightning.
The earth opening up, swallowing things. I mean, it was just unbelievable stuff going on.
We did have that pretty incredible event on the Friday practice where a bolt of lightning actually hit the track during the Red Bull Rookies Cup when those guys were out there. And apparently one guy crashed and two others were knocked unconscious and also crashed and actually took a nice big old chunk out of the track. And they caught it on video. It apparently at the same time burned out 8 of the track cameras and
lights.
The whole place got jacked up.
It went dark in there. You know, they lost all network.
Yeah. Andrew Wheeler said that he was scared to go out. So you know that it's basically a calamity.
Yeah, exactly. but amazingly enough, the rain subsided on Saturday, and you know, there was a couple of wet periods, but by the time we got to race day, it was good.
Yeah, to be frank, we were expecting a really shitty weekend weather-wise, and it didn't come out that bad. And I loved Cal's honesty about the whole thing.
The order of the races was changed because Portugal is in GMT, mm-hmm. Zulu time. And, you know, Europe rules. So they ran the 125 race after the MotoGP race. So I think we should probably cover it in that order. So Moto2 ran first, then we had MotoGP, and then we had the 125 race. Basically, we'll go from the most interesting to the least interesting.
You know? Brutal. Okay, let me run down the top 10 and then we can run through whatever events both of us remember. I know that for a fact I was exhausted. And fortunately, I'll be honest, I slept through the last half of the race. I was just tired. In fact, I slept through the first 4 laps of the GP. I tried to stay up way too long. I worked all day Saturday and I came home. Anyway, you don't need to hear my problems. You want to hear about the race. Top 10, Stefan Bradl, in a really great race that he ran, no doubt. Julian Simon, Yuki Takahashi, a great weekend for him, especially considering the circumstances that he was under. Dominika Goerta, Simona Corsi, Paolo Espargaró. I love seeing them up there, and especially the antics before the race with his brother on the grid. They were lined up next to each other. Randy Krumenacher, Alex Baldellini, Mike Maglio, and Esteve Rabat. And when I talk about the antics, those guys were actually out there, you know, bouncing around, bouncing off each other. And
sending wishes to their mom.
They were. It was very sweet. Like a pre-Mother's Day deal. We had some interesting guys go out in this race. And
Well, we had Andrea Iannone, who was, I think, 15th on the grid.
Yep.
You know, get to the front and then fall down. And remount and finish 13th. So he
still finishing the points, yeah.
We didn't mention him, but he was the series leader.
Yep, absolutely. And he's had a really interesting season. That'll get talked about more when we talk to I take that back. Yes, that will get talked about more when we talk to Mr. Suter.
Yep.
Yep. Sorry, I didn't mean to clip you in the bud there, but...
No, that's fine. I was surprised to see the Maglio up there. He hasn't shown almost anything. The thing that really sucked, I thought, was Scott Rennie had a good race, mm-hmm. and got knocked off. I don't remember who hit him.
I don't remember
I think it was Marquez, actually. Mark Marquez. Yeah,
that's right. It was Marquez.
Marquez, for the first time, didn't score points of his own accord. Actually, no, that's not true, because Qatar was really his fault, too.
Yeah, no, he's Mark Marquez, frankly, has had just an
awful start.
Yeah, crappy year. The prior race was not his fault. He got hit by Jules Cluzel. This race was his fault. Qatar arguably was his fault. Eskil talks about that too. So
He does. We'll leave that for I just wanted to mention the fact that Scott finally had his shit together.
Yep.
I'm not saying like it's his shit that's falling apart. I'm just saying that everything was working great.
And Moto2 is this thing where, you know, there's 40 riders that line up for this thing. and getting, you know, in the front three rows is hard.
Yeah.
It's incredibly hard.
Wasn't it some ridiculous, like, the two seconds covered, like, 29 riders?
Yeah.
Something?
I mean, and that's primary, you know, okay, there's a couple of things. There's a lot of talent there, but it's primarily down to the spec motor, because if you take a spec motor, you're going to have to design a chassis around it. There's really not anything super revolutionary you can do until you end, you know, and I'm really looking forward to the day when we actually get to bespoke motors. When you have different motor configurations that require different chassis setups. I'll save this until after we run the Eskil interview, but, and it was a relatively clean first lap, which is something that's nice to see in Moto 2 lately.
Three in a row.
Yeah. Well, I think
the last one, there was a crash at the very end of the first lap, but it's not that first corner pileup like we've been seeing.
Yeah. You know. I think the crashes we need to count in Moto 2 now that are actually due to Moto 2 are the ones that where they're multi-bike crashes, where one guy goes out and takes out, you know, a bunch of guys. You know, independently, people piling up is nothing unusual. It's when you have these gangbang crashes.
right.
Maybe that's not a term. Yard sale, is that more appropriate? But yeah, no, it's they're definitely running cleaner. And the bottom line is, if you're not there at the end of the first lap, you're certainly not going to be there at the end of the last. So staying on two wheels is clearly key, and especially with the tightness of these grids and, you know, qualifying and having to run up front. You know, and not everybody is an Iannone. They're not going to be able to come from way back and make a charge toward the front, regardless if they finish the race or not.
That guy's going to MotoGP next year, I'm telling you.
You think so? Well,
if he wins this championship this year, he's definitely going to MotoGP.
Absolutely.
But he's you know, he's ready, I think.
We'll have seven more riders on the grid next year. There's no reason somebody like him, you know, couldn't graduate.
Exactly. I think we both took a swig at the same time right now.
Dibby, what are you enjoying?
Just Sierra.
Okay. I've got the same old swill. Well, you know, I'm trying to have the same sound every week, but this week we actually went for fidelity. Your top five in points right now. Brattle, Iannone, and he's still in second, which is great, although he's now 13 up. Corsi, Luthi, and Simone. Takahashi following up right behind. And surprisingly enough, D'Angelo's still right up there.
We got three suitor chassis there.
We do. It's a good year. I'm actually impressed to see the Mistral doing much better this year. Tech 3 seems to kind of have it together and getting decent results, although a bit intermittent. But I don't think that's necessarily due to the chassis. We'll have to see how that works. 125s, you want to drive through this one?
No, because we're going to do MotoGP. We're going from the most interesting to the least. Remember?
Okay. Well, you know, that way we can breeze through 125.
Right. And
then you do MotoGP.
Okay, so MotoGP race had a pass.
Wait. Well, we don't have to talk about QP. We have to talk about the post-QP press conference.
Go for it.
It was fucking cool.
It was hilarious. So before, didn't this start like in the pre-race conference already? There was already sniping between Rossi and Stoner from the last race, and then it's almost like Lorenzo was feeling left out, so he started complaining about Simoncelli's aggressive riding style.
I think it actually started in 2007,
pretty much. And in qualifying, first of all, so Simoncelli was at the front of the top of the timesheets every single session, FP1, FP2, FP3. He wasn't at FP2 because half the riders didn't even bother going out. But I think Caparossi was at the top of that one. But during qualifying, we had Simoncelli just had, I think, like a 0.8 seconds on the rest of the field for a good portion. And at the very end, everybody started getting very fast, and Pedrosa, Stoner, Ben Spies, And of course, Lorenzo got up there. Lorenzo put in a great lap, picked up the pole position while Simoncelli was still out there, and Simoncelli was a third of a second faster, but crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up with him being second, and you know he came very, very close to getting his first pole position in MotoGP. And after the QP, like you mentioned, during the conference. It was an amazing exchange between Jorge and Simoncelli that just still has me in stitches. You have to pretty much watch it. We'll put a link to the transcript and if you have a MotoGP.com account, highly recommend that. But I'm sure you've already seen it if you have one. But watch it again.
You have to watch it. Yeah. And it's clear that tensions not only there, and it carried on through the weekend, which was great. Because we kind of loved that. In fact, you know that Dorna was like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah. There go the ratings up.
Yeah, there they go. Well, I all over the net, and, you know, I pay attention to these things. All of a sudden, you see a whole bunch of people, including those in the States. They're like, oh, screw it. I'm getting up at 3 a.m. and I'm going to watch this thing.
Right.
That makes a difference. That makes a huge difference. And that's the kind of stuff they notice. Do I want an all drama series? Do I want it? No. I don't want that, but at the same time, I love this. And to be honest, it gives us something to talk about. It was great. And race day dawned basically bright and clear. Saturday morning, not so much. It poured on Friday night, Saturday morning. Those guys got nailed, but race day dawned great.
It was good, and it was an interesting race. I mean, it kind of was reminiscent. Somebody made a very interesting point, because what happened during the race was basically Lorenzo was tagged by Danny for 24 laps and just wheel to wheel, but Pedrosa could not get past Lorenzo, or at least wasn't getting past Lorenzo. And I've heard people say yawn, yawn, yawn about the race, because eventually Pedrosa obviously passed Lorenzo, and then he just disappeared in the distance. Lorenzo fell off the pace. Danny up the pace, and the gap grew to 3 seconds by the end.
It would have been four laps.
But I remember that we've had races like this in the past when it was like Gibernau and Rossi, and people were screaming. So I really enjoyed it. I mean, both my wife and I were watching it, and we really enjoyed that battle between those two guys, and the fact that. We're so used to seeing Pedrosa fade at the end of the race where, sure, you know, people would catch him and stuff. This was the opposite. It was the anti-Danny, and he was so, so happy.
I think it would have been different if he hadn't passed him. And he didn't even have to win. But if he hadn't passed him and it just proceeded to the end, it might have been a little bit dry.
Yeah.
But the fact that he clearly executed a plan and out-valeted Jorge was awesome.
It was awesome, and the way he did it was not a. I mean, it was a very aggressive, not aggressive in a hit the other guy kind of way, but
he nailed the afterburners.
He dove on the brakes so deep in turn one, which was the one part where he had. He seemed to be struggling for the entire race.
Well, you know, the thing is he'd been dealing with shoulder problems for so long. You know, granted, it's a right-hand turn. You're not going to have as much pressure on your left shoulder, which is where his problem was. But for the longest time, as I'm watching, I'm like, oh, you know, he's still dealing with shoulder pain. He can't jump on the binders that quick, or at least certainly not up to Jorge's level and be able to get that deep in the corner. But yeah, he blitzed by him. But not only that, but he wicked it up out of turn one, and he was like freaking gone. And I'm like, no way he's playing that kind of distance. And he was doing the exact same thing corner after corner, going in late and deep. And I'm like, holy shit. I mean, that big, big respect, big ups to him. I was very surprised he was able to pull that off and ride that consistently all the way to the end of the race.
It was an amazing, amazing job. Big congrats. Of course, we skipped over the very beginning where all the really crazy shit happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, after all this talk about Simoncelli, so the main crux of it was that Lorenzo was claiming that Cibicelli is just too much of a, you know, aggressive rider, too much of a bully, and that he was riding dangerous. And I don't want to get into all of this because I think it's worth reading it. We're not going to do it justice. I mean, the cool-blooded Spaniard and the hot-blooded Italian, we just can't do him justice. It was freaking hilarious. But on the first lap, what, turn four, Cibicelli launched himself. And I think Colin Edwards said it best. He was like, oh, yeah, and then I was going by and I saw Cibicelli in need of a parachute.
Yeah, it was a total moonshot.
Yeah. He was okay, but after such an incredibly promising weekend and me putting him on my MCN fantasy team, I might add, he didn't get any points for that one. So he's doing the typical Cibicelli start of the season, isn't he? He's always just useless in the beginning. I mean, very, very fast, but no points, and then he kind of calms down, gets his shit together later on. So we'll see how that goes, because he's been extremely fast at every single round.
No doubt. He wasn't the only one. Man, it was kind of a mess. Also, Hector Barbera went out on lap one. I forget what that was for. Was that mechanical or was it a crash?
No, it was definitely a crash. And okay. For the longest time, I thought that that it was the two of them running together, but it was not.
Yeah, apparently, Casey Stoner was very close to Marco when he had that incident, and even he had words for him later.
Yeah, believe it or not, Casey Stoner did blame somebody for that not winning the race. No,
never happened. No, of course not.
We should mention that Casey Stoner finished third on the podium, but he ran it pretty much. He was alone. He was followed by Rossi and Dovizioso, but they were falling way behind. I think they were like, you know, 8-9 seconds behind him.
Well, since you mentioned those pair, it was a battle all the way in with Dovi and Rossi, with Dovi coming out just at the start-finish line after Valentino led him for quite some time, and he just squirted the Honda around him. Was it 2/1000ths of a second?
No, it wasn't quite. It wasn't quite the alias move. It was 2/100ths of a second.
Okay, okay, 1/1000ths, 1/100ths. It was still close.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a whole wheel instead of like a couple inches.
A big drag for Ben Spies. Who was on my fantasy team apparently. And Shades of Monza, World Superbike, right? Just from a weird mechanical stuff, if that's the case. But in this case, he had a vent hose to prevent fuel overflow while he was on the grid that was inadvertently left on the bike.
A clamp, you mean? The clamp?
Yeah, a clamp. Not a pair of forceps, but what do they call those? A clamp.
Yes.
Yeah, a clamp. That was rattling around on his bike during the race near the front brake lever, and it managed to distract him enough. He was trying to get it off, and to the point where, unfortunately, he did crash out of the race. Carol Abraham also went out, I think it was on lap two, was it not?
Yes.
Yep. So a bit of a mess at the back, and we only had 13 guys finishing in the points, or finish the race, period, and a bit of a shame.
Colin Edwards was sixth. He really loves this track, and he did well. And I think he actually said that he was very happy because this was pretty much the best he could do. And Cal Crutchlow was first time at the track, and he did great.
No doubt.
Eighth place.
I think that Cal actually has the ability. Some of these tracks are a little bit weird, maybe a little bit bumpier, much like Estoril is, to adapt quicker than some of the more billiard ball tracks.
You think that's just a British superbike?
I believe it experience? Is, especially when you're talking about weather involved.
Yeah. Tony Elias was not last.
No, he wasn't.
So after the race, now Lorenzo's lead in the championship is down to 4 points. So he's got 65. Danny Pedrosa's at 61. Then we got Casey Stoner down in third on 41 points. Valentino Rossi actually has fourth position, which is, I think, he was surprised by, 31. Nicky Hayden with 30. So those guys, we don't think of them as being up there, but and this is Jules just jumping in after the call with Jim. It occurred to me, I completely forgot to mention one thing I wanted to mention, which is that now that Danny Pedrosa won this race in Estoril, he is now tied with Max Biaggi and Randy Mamola for the most GP wins in the premier class without a world championship. So those three guys are all tied at 13 wins and no world championships. Pretty amazing. And Danny's likely to beat that record, unless, of course, he becomes a champion. That's all. Now back to where we, wherever the hell we were. Now, yeah, we've totally wrecked going through that thing. So let's just wreck 125. Let's really get that over with. Nicholas Tirole won, and he's leading the championship with 75 points because he's got maximum points. So,
and we're both exhausted, and we need to get this thing cranked out of the way. And we've
it was a really, really boring race. It's just not worth talking about.
It's a bit surprising because 125 always deliver. And I don't know.
Not this year.
It's a good point. maybe we need some really wet races to turn dry. Those are always fun.
Indeed.
Yeah. Congratulations, though, to the guys that got on the podium, Tirole, Cordesi, and Zarco.
Very cool to see him on that.
Those of you that are not big fans of our abbreviated race results, I know that you've already heard it. So get over it and don't send us email. Thank you very much. Brutal, aren't I, Jules? Let's go ahead and listen to, and I really appreciate it, and right after the results is a good time, the extended interview that Gonzalo did with Eskil Suter. And I thought it was very cool and certainly very timely, and it fills us in on a lot of blanks. Blanks from Eskil's perspective, mind you, but got to say, Gonzalo's getting some great information. He's certainly doing a fantastic job. As I said to you, Jules, when we were talking, it's like I would listen to the interview and I'm like, okay, I know what question I want to ask. And then Gonzalo would ask it. I was like, well done, sir.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
So we're here with Eskil Suter from the Suter Frames company, provider of the frames for the Moto2 Championship and the Sleeping Clutches. Well, nice to meet you for the first time. Welcome to the show again. Last time you were with Jim was before Estoril last season, and now we're again in Estoril after the race. First of all, congratulations for the podium from Simone. Unfortunately, Iannone had the small crash. How was the weekend for you?
I think, first of all, hello to everybody. Nice to have you here. Let's say the practice was very, very successful. You know, we have nine bike in the top 14, so this was never happened before. So we was very convinced that the race is looking very good for us. Finally, when the race started, there was still some wet patches and let's say quite difficult condition. Everybody was a little bit hesitating to push hard by the beginning, but then after 3-4 laps already the guys feel the track have some potential, and first Luthi, which was very confident the whole weekend and very strong in every practice, took the chance to take the lead from Bradl and push, for my opinion, a little bit too hard in that early stage for the race, and by a bump he lost the front wheel, and so then Bradl was again in lead, which was between, he was able to make some gap, and then Iannone was after a bad start, he was able to catch up very quickly. It was every lap between 0.3 and 0.7 seconds he was able to catch up and immediately arrive to Bradl in lap 20, I think 22,
I think it was around 20,
around 20. And took the lead, and I think he just pushed too hard or make a small mistake, you know, and lost the front. So for us, the race was not, let's say, not very successful, because we could expect a win or at least two bikes on the podium. Now we have a crash with Luthi and Iannone. For sure, we are not so happy for these guys. And on the other side, Julian Simon find back to his last year performance, and then this is this make us happy for the next race anyway. On the other side, we have also the young Swiss rider Dominic Eggeter on the mm-hmm. on the position 4. Okay, there was many crashes and so on, but he did very well during the whole weekend, and he increased the performance from last year. So I'm very confident he can be in future also a very good top rider.
So the weekend as a whole, apart from the race, which unfortunately, as you said, was many crashes and you had those small problems, the weekend as a whole worked well for Suri. You learn a lot more coming into Estoril this time with the good results that you have in qualifying.
Yes. Like I said, the new bike we designed for this year works very well, so we are very happy, and especially in conditions where it's not so easy to set up, like especially Estoril with the change weather conditions, it proves that our system also with support teams, with the technical support we have here on site, works very, very well, and that therefore this incredible performance in the practice was there. You know, on the other hand, you need to see that if one guy is in front with the Sutter bike, all the other guys know they have the same material. They must be able also to arrive there, so they push very hard to get there. And for sure, this was maybe one reason why we had some crashes, you know, because everybody think, okay, if this guy can go so fast on that bike, I need to do it as well. You know. But it's not only the bike, it's also the setup and the riding style all need to come together. And then if there is a small problem, they crash. You know.
Well, what were the major improvings with this new bike that you made for 2011? You learned a lot with, obviously, the first season of Moto2. What did you bring and what you get new for the bike for 2011 that makes a difference and makes it a faster, better bike than it was?
Yeah, you know, the last year when we started, everybody knew in Moto2, we did not know what we could expect from the tire, what exactly the tire likes, what kind of treatment from chassis side. That means it was starting on a white piece of paper in every point of view. And after mid-season, we find very clearly the direction to go, but by the end of the season, we had the time to finally bring in some complete new parts, which was mainly, let's explain it simple, it was more stiff, the chassis.
Well, you can go complicated. There's people that like the geeky.
Yeah, but you know, there is also some secrets I don't wanna give to the competitors. But I think I can explain a little bit. Let's say the Moto2 class is grown up to a level of GP bike. You know, before it was a kind of intermediate between super sport bikes and the GP bike, because everybody start somewhere, and then the bikes had a quite wide range. You know, let's say they had a kind of a plateau where they work. So even with the setting, if you are not on a 100% correct place, you was able to make a competitive lap time. But with the new chassis, with the new bike, we find almost 2 seconds per lap time, even with more or less the same tires than last year. So that means the performance from the chassis was increased quite a lot. And this had a disadvantage: the chassis has no big plateau anymore. You know, it's you need to ride it on the point. You know, or also the setup, you need to make it to the point. If you're a little bit away, you start immediately lose confidence or time, and that is the normal scenario we have seen in racing in the last 20-30 years. If you make a bike faster, the width of the limit getting narrower, you know. That means it's more difficult to make the setup, but finally you will be faster with this bike, you know. And this is also a progress, a steep learning curve for the riders, because some riders did not know GP bikes before, and then for them was very hard to make this step this year. from the last year to this year to get adapted to this kind of, let's say, sharp, very precise. I also can explain it in a way that, you know, with a super sport bike or with a super bike, if you make a small mistake in entry corner, you can squeeze the bike somewhere around the corner and make it happen and have a good exit. If with a GP bike you make a mistake by the entry, you will carry the mistake until end of the exit, you know. So you are not able to fix the problem you brought in by beginning of the corner. This is, I think, the main difference between a GP bike and a serial based bike, you know.
So you got them making the frame a little bit stiffer than it was, a little bit less forgiving, more like you said, a GP bike. So saying that, and saying that at that plateau, that easier setup that it was from 2010, and now 2011 being more difficult, you think that's where some of the complaints for some riders have come? You know that Kenan Sufoglu, I think, had quite an
I think Kenan had faced two problems. First of all, he's very well used to the super sport bikes, you know. So this is his own life. His whole life, he was on the list. From the two big tests we had, he missed one, and this gave him a very big disadvantage, you know, because the other riders had the time, 2-3 days in very nice conditions, to get adapted to this new bike, while he don't have the time to do it. And definitely the comments from the riders we had was that the new bike is faster, but it needs a different setup, and they all needed to find the setup. Even Lüthi and everybody needed a few days to find out what these bikes really likes, you know. And Kenan just did not have this time, and then suddenly he's dead at the first start in Qatar, and still not have solved the setup problem, you know. And this was very difficult also from outside to help him, because we did not know what is missing, you know. Finally, he said, okay, I did not have the feeling like last year, so he go back to the 2010 chassis and find back more comfortable, you know. So this is what he's riding now since Jerez race and this race here. But I talked with him today, and my opinion is he need to try to find a way to get adapted to the 2011 bike, because definitely he will have more advantage. Maybe not so much on this track, because this track is a bit special, very bumpy, and different track pattern. Or let's say sometimes you have a lot of grip, sometimes you have no grip. But if in summer the track, the tarmac getting hot, and the bikes need to be driven to the maximum or taken at the maximum, I think the 2011 chassis will have an advantage, a clear advantage against the 2010, which was not so clear here. Therefore, I hope he can adapt to the new chassis very soon. You know.
Because you were doing the test on Tuesday and Wednesday.
Yes.
You're at the track, and so you'll be back to try the 2011 and find what you need.
Yes, this is for sure one program there will do. But anyway, there was no other rider which was complaining in this direction. There was Scott Redding, which was a little bit missing front feeling, and then he tried one time the 2010 chassis just to confirm it is not the chassis, and he immediately go back to the 2011 chassis.
He tested here in Nesril or back in Jerez?
No, he tested during Jerez race, if I'm right, you know. But the rest more or less is paddock rumors, you know. There's everybody's happy, and Marquez, Lüthi, Iannone, they're all fast, you know. That's not a problem at all, yeah.
Well, Marquez, well, he was obviously been fast since the first race in Qatar, but he's missing a bit of the, well, finishing races. It's his main problem now. You think it's down to not him adjusting to the bike for a full race, for full race spec with a full full gas, even though Jerez wasn't his fault, obviously. But
no, but I think we are in... maybe he's very young and he's still missing some routine. For sure, he's adapted to the bike. He's very fast and he knows how to win races and to be fast. But this is one thing, and maybe another thing, he put also a little bit too much pressure on himself. You know, when we see the race in Qatar, which he was very, very fast on track, and then he did not give him the time to catch up slowly. The other guys, he just said, oh, before they disappear, I like to catch them up, and then he just make a riding mistake. The second race, like you said, it was not his fault. He had a small problem from Jules Cousel, which hit him from the back, and today it was also just a racing mistake. He was a little bit late on the brake, or obviously the bike stepped a bit out, and then he was just too fast into the corner, and he did not want to overtake Redding. He just running out of space, and then he hit Redding. But we can say now the same with Scott Redding. He was very strong by the end of the last season, and this year now he also has no point on his account, you know. So I think racing also need a portion of luck as well, you know. So, but I think the future is anyway for Marcus, you know. If it's not this year, it will be next year, and he's a very, very strong and clever rider.
So for you, for this year, 2011, the riders that you have riding with a Suda chassis, which one do you think will be fighting for the championship in the end? It's Simon, it's going to be Iannone. Simon seemed to be struggling a little bit to find that fine point setup, and Iannone is just absolutely fast.
Yeah, I think this is a little bit different things. Simon... they try a little bit too many things in the first race. Then in Spain, a bit of bad luck. But now it's back on pace. Iannone still had a little bit problem to bring the setup to the correct point during the practice. So he start now the third time from quite far in the back. But in the race, finally to the race, they was able to have the setting on the point, and he was very fast again today. This is for sure the two guys plus Tom Lüthi, which is very strong. If it's dry, it's hot, it's cold, it's morning or evening, he's always fast, you know. So I think these three guys will go for the championship together with Stefan Bradl and most probably Yuki Takahashi. So I think these are the four clear favorites today, but you know, Moto2, maybe in 5 weeks time everything looks different, yeah.
You know, on Thursday, actually, now that you mentioned Takahashi, on Thursday I saw Takahashi down at the pits looking at Simon's bike,
yeah,
looking at your Suda frame, maybe looking some details on the bike, see if what you're doing right, because you have a lot of fast riders doing a lot of good results.
No, I think you from outside you cannot see from the bike if something is different or it's always the complete package, you know. Maybe he just was interested in the bike, because obviously our bike from technical point of view it's the nicest or the nicest in the detail finish and the very simple build up for the mechanics to work on. And it's like a little cheapy bike, while the Moriwak is a little bit more old style, old fashioned superbike style family bike. And this is maybe he was just interested in this. Point. It was also interesting. I talked with Tony Elias by the end of the season. I said, if I need to do another season Moto2, I would like to jump on your bike. You know?
Maybe that's what he should have done. Instead of moving up to MotoGP, I'm sure that if he kept himself with Moto2 and a Suda frame, he would be a lot faster.
Yeah, but I don't know. He's a fast rider. He also won this GP some years ago. I think it was 2007. He's a fast rider. I don't know. Maybe he lost his confidence at the moment a bit on the MotoGP bike. He's not find the rhythm. But when you see everybody's new to MotoGP now, they need a half a year or a year to adapt to the bikes. Simoncelli was the same last year. This year is very strong. So it's the top of the top. You know, in MotoGP there is no slow riders around, and there is the creme de la creme. So that means you need to be 100% one with your bike and your crew to be fast, and if it's just a few percent missing somewhere, you are not able to compete against others. Yeah.
Now that you mentioned MotoGP, well, obviously you have the Moto1 bike that you have here at the track. Are you excited? Is the bike going in the right direction that you want, ready for next year?
It's too early to say. You know, we had the first two rollouts, more or less. The first one with Michelin tires, because there was monster discussion that maybe the tire manufacturer in MotoGP will change for 2012. And then that was the point why we was testing first with Michelin. The second rollout, it was clear that Bridgestone will be the tire supplier again for 2012 onward. Therefore, there was no point to test again with Michelin, and we did not have tires at all. So what we have done, we took Moto2 tires, and then the second rollout was just to set up a bit electronic. But even that was not possible, because the Moto2 tire, which works very well on the Moto2 bike now, did completely not work on the MotoGP bike, because there is so much power and the tire was overheating. Therefore, the test was more or less for nothing. So I think on Tuesday we start on a white piece of paper again, and then with the Bridgestone tire, I need to find the way forward to set up the bike, to set up the electronic, to find out the chassis geometry and everything. So I don't think we can expect crazy good lap times. On the other hand, we have also not so much time to prove our concept, to prove this bike will be fast. It means we need to be between August and September, we need to be on pace, that we see, okay, we are within that lap time, we are close to the position 10 to 20 in the MotoGP field, and this is what we're looking for. So there's for sure a lot of work to do, and we are not dreaming that we put the bike on the track and we'll be faster than anybody else. So we have to learn, we have to work, we have to put the electronic together and cut dents by dents and arrive somewhere in the area where we see, okay, if we continue working, we will be able to catch some of the satellite teams for next year. This is more or less the idea.
Who were you having testing the bike on Tuesday?
It's always Carmelo Morales at the moment, and if everything is going well, then maybe we give Scott Redding a few laps. When I have seen today the race, the Moto2 guys did a 42.0, let's say the last few MotoGP guys did a 40.0, so that means we are missing there about 2 seconds per lap. Should be able, if everything works well, to find out if we can catch up these 2-3 seconds on a similar bike concept, but with a much more stronger engine and the MotoGP electronics and everything like that.
Because you took most of what you know from the Moto2 bike and the Moto2 now GP bike from 2011, used it on the new Moto1?
No, completely not. The fact is that the BMW superbike engine is, from the outside shape, is very close to the 600 engine we use in Moto2. Therefore, we can carry over a lot of parts, but it doesn't mean it's a similar bike. is a completely different bike. We built a completely different chassis, completely different swing arms. For sure, we took the same pressing molds because this is the big investments when you do a new chassis. So we can save that money and instead of use it for testing. Obviously, the bike looks from 10 meters away quite similar because we take the same bodywork. We don't spend the money to create a different bodywork for the time being because it's a really early stage of testing. So we could save a lot of money to use for development instead of making aerodynamics or whatever because we just carry over these parts from the Moto 2.
How much interest do you have from different investors and team to have your frame for next season? Are you planning on having more than one bike running?
Yeah, let's say the word frame is a little bit wrong because let's say it's really start to getting a complete bike. Okay, the basic engine is from BMW, but there we need to that we will change a lot of things as well. So finally, it's a complete bike concept we have available. What I have learned that is a lot of people who think to enter in MotoGP with these new rules. But what I also think that is many of these teams is a kind of they don't see it very realistically. You know, they think it's like Moto2. You can put a bike together and install the engine and be fast. And this is not the case in MotoGP because it's not a new class and everybody start new. It's existing, let's say, the Formula One of the motorcycle racing. And you can imagine these are many years of development and so on and so on. So I'm not dreaming that we come in and immediately we'll be there. So it's a hard bit of work, and I think this is underestimated from some let's say competitors who like to do the same.
From the 17 teams that applied for the next season, because the list came out from FIM,
and there's a lot of teams who apply, but by the end of the night you need to have the sponsorship. Maybe it's not that expensive as a current MotoGP package, but for sure you need to get a few millions to run the whole story through the year still like that. And this is one thing, and the other thing is I think there's about 4 or 5 positions left on the grid to come up to the bike numbers which Dorna like to have on the grid for next year. So I hope we can have 2 or 3 bikes in there, but also I think we are the only project which is that far advanced that we're already are testing and have some strategy to build the bikes next year.
So what do you think about the rules? Well, obviously the claiming engine rule and all that, and the more fuel for those kind of teams. The rules are not yet completely defined, but you've been working with what exists. What do you think about it? Do you think it's a good set of rules for you that come into the championship?
I think generally is a good way to start reducing the costs in MotoGP. I'm not 100% convinced that we want to participate as a claiming rule team. You know, maybe we just participate as a MotoGP team because I think the advantage of the little bit more fuel bring us not that much advantage. Instead of the disadvantage, not spending too much money into the engine to be able to compete, you know, to the top guys. That means the claiming rule was made that the teams not spending too much money into the engine development. You know. On the other side, we need to be competitive, and if it's necessary to build a more expensive engine, we need to build a more expensive engine. And like this, it's clear that we don't like to participate as claiming rule team where the the owner or the other manufacturers has the possibility to claim one of our engines, which cost us a lot of money to develop. You know? So the decision is not taken if he departs a claiming rule setup, or as we just go in MotoGP, that's it with the Sutter bike.
But if you go into MotoGP with a MotoGP bike instead of a CRT, won't that mean that your engine needs to be fully prototype and not production based?
This has nothing to do with the if you read the rules. If you read the rule says you need to have a 1,000cc bike. End of the story. And how many parts is what is a production bike and what is not production bike? I think if you go today to the superbike paddock, you don't will find many parts on the bikes which is production bike. So this is I don't think a problem. So or I'm sure it's no problem. We need to make a bike and. Maybe some of the parts coming from a production bike, maybe not, but this is really not the point. The point is that we need to find a way to make a competitive bike to reasonable costs, because I think this is the future for MotoGP, because the world economic situations will not allow also in the next few years budgets like it was in the past, you know. So every team will struggle to find enough sponsorship to have the, let's say a Honda or Ducati full factory package, you know. And I think this is our aim, to build a competitive as possible bike at reasonable costs. So this is our aim. And like I said, we will take decision around August, September, where we are and what we are doing. If we participate as claiming rule, if we participate just as a normal MotoGP setup, or if we don't participate at all, you know, this is a possibility.
Well, you're talking about reducing costs. Which is...
Yeah, 2 minutes.
Obviously, electronics are a big discussion in terms of how they're actually effective in terms of, because you need to have a very good electronic package nowadays to compete in MotoGP. Is it your opinion that should be controlled too, or should it be free electronics like it is now? And
actually. Personally, I hate the electronic development direction which was going in the last few years, you know. It means at the moment we have a corner-by-corner strategy, so you are able to program every corner into the ECU, so that the ECU is intelligent enough that the bike knows where it is on the track. That means in that corner you have this percentage of slip, and the next corner you have that setup, on the next corner have that setup. That means you need to come to the track with a few electronic guys which don't do anything else than find the proper setup for the track in the two three practice sessions you have available. And I think this is a wrong development. So this is one thing I would like to address, that they should ban a corner-by-corner strategy. This is the first thing. The second thing is with the 1,000cc bike, let's say the influence of the electronic will be for sure a little bit less than with 800cc bikes, because with 800cc you have to make quite a picky engine to create the power you need on the straight line. And okay, then you need the electronic to smoothen the engine for the corner. And with the 1,000cc bike, you have anyway, let's say, enough power to cover the straight line. Yeah. That means the torque behavior is a little bit more smooth, and the electronic influence should be a little bit less. At least this is my opinion. And but any restrictions there from donor side or from FEM side will be, for my opinion, very welcome to reduce the cost on the electronic side.
So we should be looking into finding a way to reduce the electronics and maybe go with a standard ECU like it's been talked and it's used now in Formula 1. Well, if you do, like you said, you're still going to figure it out what's going to be the plan for next year. But how much is that going to impact your Moto 2 project in terms of supplying, which is now 14 bikes? Is it going to affect in terms of cost? Will you try to keep the two things running at the same point? Or
I think as more as we do, as more we can split the costs we have anyway. You know, we are on track. We have the support here. We need to carry a big vehicle all around the places. And we can split more the cost for testing. We can have some synergy, use it in all the projects. Therefore, I think for us it's just a benefit to have additional action going on. For sure, we need to bring more people in. We need to bring more logistic in. But by the end of the day, we also can split all the costs on the other side. Like you see now, these two testing days we have in front of us, this is only possible because we have 13, 14 bikes on the grid. If we have only two, we cannot rent the track. But now, if you rent the track and split between all the riders, the costs are very low for everybody. So this is a big advantage. And this is also one point why we plan to make a Moto 3 bike for next year. Because we are anyway here, we have the support and so on and so on. So bring a few more guys in and make a competitive Moto 3 bike, then we have the full range, and it starts to make more and more sense. You know?
That was actually my next question. I was going to ask you, what's your intentions with Moto 3 coming in? You're already working on want a bike for Moto 3 then?
We work on a complete bike. We are in the design stage of engine and chassis. Let's say we are about 50-60% on the way. The idea is to present the bike around July, August to the potential customers, and then we go from there. Our aim is sure that to make a bike which is very competitive. We cannot compete against Honda with the production racer like this, so it will be not a cheap bike, but it must be a very fast bike. This is the only way for success for us.
So you're going to use your own engine?
Yes.
You're designing your own engine?
Yeah.
Okay, now, well, let's go, because I remember the last time you've been in the show, it was asked about your two-stroke project, your V4 500 project, and by then you didn't know yet when it was going to be available for ordering. How is that project going? Is it completely finished and ready for?
There is also, we are on the stage, design is finished. We start producing now the first few engines to start testing with, and somewhere towards the end of the year, we like to start testing with that bike.
Yeah. Okay. You're going to have one for yourself to go do some laps around?
Yeah, sure. Just make sure I'm fit enough to do it. On the other hand, we have quite a big interest all around the world, you know, to get these bikes, because never really a V4, let's say, factory bike was available on the market for public, you know. And if you ever have ridden a V4 500, you know this is the top of the motorcycle. Never ever you will be able to have something similar. I always explain it like this: if you sit now on a today GP bike, Moto GP bike, with all the electronics and the four-stroke technology, is very smooth and user-friendly. You know, you can stay on the saddle and pull a wheelie down the straight without any big experience. While on the two-stroke 500 from past days, you're already scared when you ride out of the pit lane. So I think this is the real ultimate kick for a bike rider to have once a go on a GP 500 bike.
So I noticed some sadness when you say that we moved from that kind of bikes to what we have now then.
Yeah, like I was a racer myself, and then the time is changing. We must also see from pollution point of view, from the strategy, from all the factories to make emission less, less emission with the bikes and so on and so on. You are not as a manufacturer, as a big manufacturer, not allowed to do two-stroke technology anymore. While we are in the position as a small company that we have the possibility to make some crazy things for crazy people. And actually, it was born like when you talk, my brother and myself, and we talk to each other and said, "Hey, we should really do something which just is for fun, you know, instead of only working day and night on other projects. Let's do something which just make fun, and maybe by the end of the day, even have a success from business point of view." And Dev said, "Okay, let's make a 500."
This was the first thing you thought of in terms of, if you're going to do something crazy, let's do something crazy there. Everyone yes. would love.
Exactly.
Okay, Mr. Suda, thank you very much for your time. Glad to see you around, and good luck for the next few races, and let's hope you bring on the championship.
Then. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very, very cool. I already said that, but I'll say it again. And it was great to hear from Eskil again. I actually had one question. What was the question I had? Besides today being Wednesday, Mark VDS was running at Estoril in testing, and they also ran the their M1 prototype with a BMW S1000 engine. And I think I sent that out to you guys. You see that, Jules? I should mention that today is Jules Cisek's birthday. Happy birthday, dude.
Oh, thanks. Actually, it's also Jorge Lorenzo's birthday. So happy birthday, Jorge Lorenzo.
It's good for you guys to have something in common. I'm assuming that he's not completely jacked up on birthday cake right now.
He may be. Who knows? He's probably jacked up on something else. No. No, he's very clean. He's a clean boy.
He's jacked up on hate for Marco.
Oh, yeah.
He's plotting a, you know, some sort of horrible Spanish bomb plot. And on that note, just a couple of little notes here, and then we'll Monza is coming up this coming weekend. I'm very stoked, a track that you love to hate.
I'm not saying anything.
Miller Motorsports Park will be at the end of May. We're well into the month of May. We got plenty of racing going on. We did have BSB Alton Park this last weekend. Those of you that have had the opportunity to watch it, being all of our UK and Europe friends, that was some great racing. And it looks like we'll have a pretty cool interview from one of the protagonists up near the front, if not at the front, soon. Just to mention real quick, 11 days from now, you and I are going to be at Infineon Raceway for AMA Pro Racing and TTXGP, just like last year.
Yep.
If you guys want to meet up for that, let us know. We'll chat about it on the Facebook fan page, email us at motopod@motopodcast.com, and we can figure out the logistics. Last year we tried it. Was it last year or the year before?
Last year.
I think Skyler showed up, right?
Yeah.
I love you, Skyler. We want to get a bigger group out there, and not like we're going to get the same thing that we've had for any GP or Laguna Seca GP.
If you're in the area, if you're going to Infineon to watch the AMA round, just let's shoot us an email and we'll try to get together.
And those of you that were soured on AMA, come out. Infineon is an awesome course, and it's been pretty busy lately. They had a test today and yesterday at Miller Motorsports Park in preparation for this year, because they're going to be running with World Superbike out there at the end of May. But they will be out here. It's a great course. We'll have TTXGP and AMA has to turn itself around. It's definitely worth attending as a spectator. The pricing is great. Right now, let's go ahead and run Kenny Noyes, and we'll roll that through. Kenny was a bit sour this weekend, and understandably, although, you know, he got 17th, but damn, the boy wants to be in the points. So,
he's progressing upwards. I mean, I think the first race he was like 28th, and he was like 22nd, now he's 17th. So, you know, it's not all bad.
What we need is for him to repeat his performance at the next race at Le Mans and get on the pole. But instead of not having a successful finish, wipe that thing out and put you on the box. But anyway, we'll run through this. Go, Kenny.
Well, we're here with Kenny Noyes, friend of the show. It's your third time on the show now. So how'd the weekend go? How'd you feel?
It's been a tough weekend for us. Started off good on Friday, and then on Saturday morning, also it was going pretty good. But in qualifying, we just weren't able to get going quick enough, and started way back in 27th. Then the race came up, and I was in a really good group. At the beginning of the race, it seemed easy to stay with them. But then towards the end of the race, I think we've figured out some of our setup issues with this race, because it's the first one that I've been okay with my shoulder, so I could push the whole race. And at the end, the bike is a lot harder to get into the corners, and we have a lot more shatter problems. So you know, the positive thing is we learned. The negative thing is we weren't able to stay with the group that would have put us in the points.
All right. Well, you're saying that your shoulder is finally good, but you made a mess out of it on warm up with that high slide.
Yeah. Warm up on the first lap, coming out in the wet. Just you know, got on the gas a little bit too hard for the cold rain tire and high side, and landed right on my shoulder. So that didn't help either. It's been a tough weekend, man. You know, for me and for the team, worked a lot, and you know, just hard not to get the result we're looking for.
Well, obviously, you didn't have time for any pre-season testing. You're just straight out of the box coming into racing straight away for Qatar. Well, we're three races in. How's the feeling improving? Your work with the team and all that.
Yeah, well, like I said, it's the first weekend that I've been able to do more than five laps in a row without pain. So this weekend we've learned more than in the first two races, for sure. And I think we got a good idea now of what our problem is. And, you know, before with the shoulder, it was hard to tell if it was the bike, if it was me, you know, what was fading more at the end of the race. But now it's pretty clear that we have a problem as the gasoline, you know, gets used up and the tires. So they'll go over the data, and hopefully for Le Mans we'll be able to put something together for the full race.
So you work better with this FTR frame than you did the previous season with the Aris one?
Yeah, I mean, with the last season it was the opposite. You know, I had a really long, good preseason and came into it real strong, whereas most of the other teams hadn't tested much. So this year it's kind of the opposite. You know, I was laid up all winter and didn't have any strength in the first test to do anything, and then even the first race, like Qatar, you know, about five laps into it, my shoulder was in serious pain. So it's cool to be strong again, and now we just gotta figure out our setup.
Well, yeah, because you have Le Mans next, but then you're back in Spain for Catalunya, a track that you know from the CEV. You think you're going to have, with the problems out there, and you think you're going to have a chance there to
result? Hopefully we can find a good base setup and have a bike that's going to be competitive. Those were the best tracks for me last year. Got the pole in Le Mans and then came back from 27th to 7th in Catalunya. So those on paper are our best tracks. So hopefully, you know, we can have a competitive package and be strong.
And then Bluesons team, you guys are three packed in the small cream garage. How's your relationship with Yoni, with Rabat, and in terms of sharing information and all that? Do you guys work in the same direction, or it's impossible for you to?
Yeah, well, I got Bitubo suspension, so it's a little different, but yeah, we do data. And it's cool. I like them. I like Yoni and Tito. Get along good with them. So no, that's in general, the team's good. Good atmosphere.
Good. Well, Kenny, really nice to talk to you. Hope best of luck for the man. Hopefully the pole again. See you up there again. And thank you.
It seems far away right now. But it did last year also. You know, last year, it seemed like, you know, when I first got to Le Mans, I think I was 27th or something. It seemed really difficult, and then it clicked. So we just got to figure out the way for it to click again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Thank you very much, and have the rest of a good weekend.
Cool, thank you.
All right. Thanks again, Kenny. Once again, thank you, Gonz. Very cool. And we'll have Gonzalo on next week to kind of recount his personal experiences at the track. It's very cool. And many, many thanks, dude, for covering for us. You've done a great job up there above and beyond expectations. And for your first time as a motor journalist, I think you kicked ass.
Yeah, not only that, but he was also captured in a lot of photographs. So he was definitely around. If you follow him on Facebook, he was getting tagged by, you know, Kevin Schwantz photographers, and I think it was Northcott or Wheeler, or with Wheeler,
yeah,
in the background. that was a good shot.
You know, the Fantasy League, the Motopod Fantasy League, dude, I am like occupying the freaking basement in this thing. I should just give up.
Yeah, well, you know, some people have it, some people don't.
I did okay BSB-wise, and I knew I was going to, and I actually saved some picks to try and do that. Those of you that are wondering what the fuck we're talking about the MCN Fantasy League, and there is a specific Motopod League, and we'll put a link into the show notes for that. And it's fun. What have we got? 200-something people in there now? It's crazy.
It's like, yeah, 250 or something.
Yeah. Definitely one of the largest leagues, and I'm definitely... I think I'm like number 200. Normally, I do well in these things. In fact,
turn it around, dude. You can still turn it around.
You got anything else, Jules? Is there anything that we're missing at this point?
God, I hope not.
Because we've completely hacked. It's a hack job, isn't it?
It is. It is.
You know what? We
tried. We tried to make this call happen like 2 days in a row. So you're getting the goods.
Well, maybe soon. Martin will be back and he'll straighten our shit out.
Yeah,
We need something.
He's pro.
We need the whole British calming influence.
Nice. All right, take care, everybody.
Later. We are such fucking dorks.